Welcome back, everybody, to the Gaming Careers Podcast. We have a very special episode today, as I think the first time, actually, Ben, since we've restarted this podcast and you've been my co-host, we have ourselves a guest on the show. I'm sure Julian doesn't need any introduction, but for those of you that didn't watch Elgato's launch event the other day, you might not have seen his face before. But Julian, you're the GM of Elgato. You're basically where the buck stops. You make all the design decisions. Thanks so much for coming on. We've got tons of questions. I know a lot of people in the audience are super excited about all of these new products that have been released. I think it was 9 different products that you guys have ended up doing. But first and foremost, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much for having me on. Big fan of the channel, so excited to be here.
Yeah, I mean, you're always welcome to come on whenever you decide to put 9 different products out on a single day. I feel like okay. It warrants its own event. But I guess let's just start straight away with 9 different products that you released. What is your favorite, your personal favorite out of the 9 that you did?
I love them all in different ways. I mean, entering the camera space is exciting, right? Designing a camera from scratch was for us a huge learning experience, and it's a fairly complicated challenge. So that's super interesting, and we're all pretty excited to have this out in the open now. But all the products were a lot of fun to work on. I think actually the low profile mic arm is going to end up being the kind of sleeper hit out of this entire thing. And it's funny, we often joke that, you know, we spend so much time trying to develop the most complicated thing, and what ends up doing the best is something that is so simple, like a mic arm. But hey.
Yeah, I think I could probably echo that. I know that we're going to talk maybe about the mic arm a little bit later, but I think that's the product that I've had the most questions about, and I just didn't expect it. You know, I kind of threw a little segment into my review video being like, oh, they did 2 new mic arms, and if you wanted to see a full mic arm comparison, I think I now own about 7 or 8, so I can get some time with each of them, and everybody is asking about the low profile mic arm. But yeah, for me, I think the camera, obviously I've known about this for a little while, but Ben, you've been kind of in the dark. Yeah. I even held you back, not telling you anything about it until Thursday, so we couldn't even send ahead like some example questions that we were going to talk about with Julian. We wanted to wait until you saw it for the first time. What about you, Ben? What took your fancy from the products that were released?
Yeah, I had the blind perspective of just like everybody else, having no idea what was going to come out. That was pretty cool. I think the camera seems like it was probably the most anticipated thing that I saw come out. Julian, would you agree that was like the biggest request you guys had?
Yeah, I mean, it's the one product that I think people have been expecting us to do to sort of round out the product offering. And, we went pretty overboard with the pre-seeding and the boxes and the hints. So I think a lot of people had a pretty good idea that it was going to be some sort of camera.
I was super surprised by how much got announced. I mean, I could tell because there was so much promotional content leading up towards the reveal, but just all the different products that came out. I think for me, the biggest surprise was the Wave XLR, probably, in terms of just what it kind of offers and how it fits into the whole category. I agree the camera is probably the one that people were looking for the most, and I've seen probably the most coverage about. But for me, I think the Wave XLR really stands out too as a kind of a secret surprise that I was really excited about.
Yeah, I think the face cam, from my point of view, was something that I thought Elgato might at some point go into, because obviously you've got a bit of a portfolio now in terms of the camera side of things. I think it was last year you acquired Epoch Cam, and you've been developing and improving that. And then on fire, there's an ice cream van going past. So if you hear that, sorry, I'm not listening to Harry Potter music in my headphones. It's just the ice cream van. But now you've got Epoch Cam, and then on the other side, you know, you're still supporting people that want to use professional DSLR or mirrorless cameras through HDMI with Camlink 4K and now Camlink Pro as well. So I guess I was kind of surprised that you did want to put a product in the middle of that, but I mean, I'm always impressed whenever I receive anything from Elgato about how much thought they've put into the creator side of things and really trying to solve problems for creators that have existed indefinitely throughout the whole of webcam experience. Even simple things like being able to save the settings to flash memory in the camera. I'm sure that wasn't a simple thing to implement, but like that hasn't been done before and makes such a difference to the actual creator's experience when they're, you know, opening up the camera in a new app or changing computer or anything like that. So, yeah, talk to us a bit about the design process of building Facecam. What was that like? Did you just start with the usual brief of what problems are streamers having with webcams and how can we make that better? Or is it much more detailed than that?
To a certain extent, I mean, we're pretty community driven in our roadmap, I would say. So a lot of these decisions that we make are just based on observing what the community is doing. I mean, that's how Camlink came about, right? This was, you look 6-7 years back and people were already connecting high-end cameras to capture cards because they were so unhappy with the quality of webcams and there was just no step up. And so, you know, we observed that and said, okay, well, at least we can make this process of using a professional camera as a webcam a lot more streamlined and easy and cost-effective, actually, to combat the title of this live stream a little bit. And, you know, Epoch Cam was another trend in that direction where we just thought, look, the cameras on phones are so good. And realistically, a phone can be a better webcam than most of the webcams out there today. And this is a trend that we see playing out in the long term. You know, people keep upgrading their phones every so often. And at some point, you know, you're probably going to have some old phone laying around that's going to make a pretty good webcam. Even if it's not your primary camera, it's just something that you use for a second angle or something that you can use wireless to show stuff off. And we've kind of always tried to fill these use case needs. Webcams, we started exploring seriously in 2019 just because, you know, there continued to be demand. People were asking us, hey, are you guys going to make a webcam? You know, I have this or that product, but it's really not the best. And I don't want this whole DSLR or mirrorless setup. I just want a webcam that's plug and play and that looks good. And that's when we set out to kind of look at the space and define what a product would look like that came from us. And I think a lot of the design decisions we made are maybe non-typical, right? Like leaving the mic out, ditching autofocus, kind of putting the cost of the product elsewhere was all done with what I think is a pretty deep understanding of how we think people want to use this product and also how they're not going to use this product.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's part of what I put into my review, basically. I highlighted a few of what I would consider the common complaints that I would see people saying, you know, how can I spend $200 on a webcam that doesn't have autofocus or a microphone? And then addressing those really, because, I mean, certainly with the microphone, there's nobody should be using the microphone for a webcam, so that's definitely the right decision. The autofocus one, the more I've thought about it, the more now I think it makes sense, especially with the product being named Facecam. And actually, even in the comparison video, when I was looking at some of the competitor webcams, when I stood further back, even the cameras that do have autofocus really struggled to pick out what the subject of the video was anyway. So yeah.
It's maybe a little bit counterintuitive because you think, okay, well, you're leaving something out. It doesn't have this feature, but really we're optimizing for a different feature and a different use case. And so we kind of looked at, okay, how are most webcams handling autofocus and how much value does it really create? And more than not, what we saw is just, okay, you're holding something close, it focuses, you pull it back, it doesn't refocus, you got to move around, okay, can the camera capture me, or it's focus hunting or something, to where a lot of people simply turn it off, right? Now, you can turn it off and you can do manual focus, but then the range at which it's optimized is going to be severely limited compared to a camera that just has a fixed focus range out of the gate. So what we have here is, you know, I can hold something here and it's going to be in focus. I can move back here, I'm still going to be in focus. I just don't have to worry about it. It's going to look good. And, you know, in my opinion, that's not the worst thing for a camera that you're going to use exactly in this type of setup as all three of us look right now, which is, it's in the name. That's what it was designed for. You know, it sits here, it captures your face, and that's about it. It's got a very specific task and it's optimized for that task.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, especially if you can sacrifice a few features that most streamers especially are not going to use at the benefit of being able to enhance some of the features that really matter. Like, I think having like the prime lens is really cool to have on that product, and the Sony sensor and everything like that is such a unique take on it. So I, for a streamer side, I think it makes a lot of sense. But I did want to talk a little bit about you released a lot of products, like I said earlier, all at once. And I think that was probably the first time Elgato's done anything like that in the past. Is that right? In terms of all kind of at once instead of dripping one by one. Right. So what was that like for you guys to kind of start preparing for an event like this in terms of so much coming out at the same time? Can you kind of give some story of the context before that happened?
It wasn't initially planned like this. It's not like we sat here, you know, a year ago and said, oh, in July 2021, we're going to have this huge event. It just, you know, some products get delayed. Others end up coming in maybe even faster than you anticipated. And so it sort of in, say, maybe March of this year, it started crystallizing that all this stuff was somehow colliding in July. And so at that point, I made the decision, and I think probably a lot of people on our marketing team hate me for it, that we're going to pack it all into one event and just try to, try to wow people a little bit for one day, and also put out something that's maybe unexpected. It was a learning experience. We've never done anything like that before. You know, we've maybe had sort of keynotes at CES and stuff like that, but never to this extent. So it was A, sort of just reacting to how things were unfolding, and B, wanting to try something new, and seeing, you know, how people would engage with it, and people found it interesting or not. So,
and then
there's no long-term master plan. It's sort of, I think, as sometime in March, maybe, is when this started becoming a reality or something that we thought we were going to do.
And then 1 hour before you release, Valve decides to release the Steam Deck. I mean, I can only imagine the panic stations behind the scene, or was everybody quite chilled about the fact that it's only one letter different to, obviously, the new Stream Deck that you released, the refreshed Stream Deck? That was just the timing of that. I thought if it wasn't planned, it was very unfortunate.
There's definitely a lot of amusement internally about the name. You know, I think at that point we were pretty focused on our own story, and was like, okay, they announced this and it's getting a lot of coverage and that's awesome, but we got to focus on executing our story for the next few hours. The name is funny. I mean, just the play on names between the two products is great. I don't know. I don't really have too much more to add to it. It looks like an interesting device.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to see how it went down. It must have been, I would have been stressed thinking, oh my God, we've spent so much time planning this event, and then that happens right before. But I guess it maybe there were some spelling mistakes of people tweeting about the Steam Deck and getting more coverage of the Stream Deck, who knows.
That definitely happened. I mean, I think at the moment of announcement, if you Googled Steam Deck, Google recommended you, are you looking for Stream Deck? So I would say at that point, we actually got more coverage than we would have. So it wasn't all bad.
Yeah, excellent. Let's jump back into the talking about the camera, because like I mentioned in my review, I think one of the big selling points with a lot of Elgato products, and this has really been true, I think, especially since Wave 1 and Wave 3 microphones, is that the software is almost the bigger selling point. Like you make a really, really good hardware product, and then that extra glimmish gets unlocked by using the software. And I think that's true as well with the Camera Hub software. But I wonder how do you manage to balance? Because obviously you're appealing to such a huge market now, and you have these like pro level features that we haven't seen in webcam software before, where you can, you know, see an ISO readout, you can change the shutter speed of the camera. But at the same time, you're also trying to appeal to new streamers, people that are, maybe this is the first camera that they're ever buying. And how do you manage to balance like appealing to both people that want all those extra features, as well as making it simple and easy for a first time streamer to use?
I mean, I think overall, we certainly cater to enthusiast users, power users, and it doesn't really matter how big their reach or their following or whatever it is, but we do cater to people who are somewhat curious about this, or at least are a little bit more technically inclined, right? So it's not, you know, even Facecam is not, I wouldn't recommend it to someone who just wants any webcam to plug in and use on Zoom, because realistically, you need to open Camera Hub and you need to manually tune your settings a little bit, and you need to want to do that and actually, you know, get excited and nerd out about it a little bit. This is not a product that just plug it in and whatever. I think it's more for the people that they like the thought of having a camera where they can actually have some control over what's happening. Now, exerting that control, that should be intuitive, and that's where we invest a lot of time into the software experience in an attempt to just make it easy. And that's the same thing with Wavelink. You know, it's not necessarily doing something that's never been done before. There's been free tools, open source tools, other tools to do the same thing. But I think through a pretty diligent focus on UI and user experience, we managed to make it a little bit more accessible to people. And the stuff is overall complex. I mean, when you're talking about submixes of up to 9 different inputs for different, it's fairly complex when you're doing it. Dialing in, you know, your ISO and your shutter speed and all the stuff for your webcam is also not necessarily something people are used to. But, you know, it's part of what makes working in this space so fun is you're dealing with a community that's generally very curious. And wants to learn and wants to push the boundaries. And so I think what we've gotten fairly good at over the years is kind of finding that balance of, you know, opening up enough of a feature set, but not making it so convoluted that you really need to watch, you know, 5 hours of YouTube tutorials to figure out where to begin.
Yeah, I think it really does strike a good balance between giving you the real, you know, professional level controls, but still being very accessible. I haven't been hands-on with the software yet, but based on Pete's video and what I've seen so far, it does seem fairly intuitive to use the software, and it adds a lot of things that people have been asking for a while, like the memory and pieces like that. So I think it makes sense, though. I mean, is that kind of the perspective you take for all your products, is to market to the real enthusiasts and not necessarily the entry-level streamer or creator in general?
I think so, yeah. I think, look, to if you're in the market for any of our products, I think you self-identify as some sort of enthusiast, because you're looking to invest in dedicated equipment or for something that you're interested in or passionate about. And I think when you're, it doesn't matter if you're talking about leveling up your audio or your video, or you're looking for better gear to mount your equipment, or, you know, green screen for professional chroma keying, at any point when you're making that decision, you're really identifying into someone who wants to level up to a certain extent. And, you know, again, I don't think that has to be correlated 100% to I have a big audience, so I need to invest into gear. It's more like, this is my hobby and this is something I enjoy doing, so I want the best, right? And that goes for, you know, people that build their own gaming PCs or people that invest heavily into a sport, into their golf clubs or tennis racket or into their car or whatever. This is just, you know, I think a new hobby that's proliferating for a lot of people.
I mean, whilst we're on the topic of investing in the hobbies, like the clickbaity title of this video, I think a lot of people have this initial reaction to Elgato products that, you know, you could build it cheaper yourself. And I think it started probably with the Stream Deck, and you could make a numpad and, you know, print out tiny little things that you stick on, and people often don't get the understanding of how good the experience is. Or if you look at the key lights, being able to customize the color temperature or the brightness directly from your computer or from your Stream Deck, things like that, people don't understand that building features like that cost money. And yes, they are convenient, and yes, you can probably find a cheaper alternative on Amazon where you have to stand up and reach behind the light to change the color temperature or any of those things. But I feel like I've seen less of those comments with the recent products, like all the products that you've released this year. So if we even go back to talking about wave panels and LED strips and things like that, I think I've seen less comments recently like that. Does that ever grate on you, that narrative that always comes out that I could build this for $10 with a hammer and nail?
I have to say, it used to really annoy me. I've gotten used to it. At this point, I'm always... think it's weird when we don't get those kind of comments. There's two extremes of the spectrum, right? I mean, we'll talk about the spectrum. Oh, this is completely overpriced. The other spectrum is, you know, people are looking at this and saying, we get this with Stream Deck a lot from the pro AV field. Like, I can't believe how cheap this thing is. Let me buy 10. Because they're used to buying ATEM switchers for 10 grand, you know, and those aren't nearly as customizable. So it's all a matter of perspective. And the same goes with the mic arms. The mic arm LP is $99. We got a lot of comments like, what, $100 for a mic arm? Are you crazy? The most competitive thing to it costs $400. So on that scale, it's, you know, ridiculously cheap. To someone else, it's ridiculously expensive. So I've sort of given up on trying to rationalize against us. What does bother me is when people, you know, link me stuff on Amazon or be like, hey, this is exactly the same thing and it costs, you know, 10%. It's definitely not exactly the same thing, right? So it starts with the components that actually go into the products, which for lights is the LEDs. You know, for our lights, these are all OSRAM LEDs. They're literally hand selected to make sure the output of each LED is exactly the same. This kind of stuff we aren't going to put into spec sheets for you, but it's, we pride ourselves into shipping you something that's just going to be pretty much perfect when you get it. Now, you can cheap out along the way on anything. You can cheap out with the clamp that you put on a mount, with the metal that you use in the mount, with having cable routing or not, with the thread that the light attaches to, with the fact that the metal back has, you know, pattern printed on it. Now, these are all little details that we would rather invest in versus not. And the approach to product development is not how can we make the cheapest product. It's, okay, how can we make the best product? And let's see what it costs in the end. And if this is something we can reasonably take to market. I think that's ultimately a mindset thing. You can always find something cheaper. It doesn't matter what you're shopping for. It doesn't matter if it's a mic or a camera or a bottle of water. You'll always find something cheaper. And if that's the only thing you're after, then, you know, by all means, I think that's your right. But that's not really where we play or where we feel comfortable. The goal is to try and, you know, provide as good a product as possible, and also, you know, stick to a certain sense of premium quality in what we deliver. Plus, there's a software component, which obviously is a pure expense, right? Software development cost is a pure expense that you need to some extent, factor into the price of your hardware if that's the way you monetize, which for us is how we monetize.
Yeah, I think one thing that I did in my Elgato Wave review is I directly compared it with the super cheap stuff and the super expensive stuff. And then you could really see what you're paying for. And I think a lot of people agreed through videos like that it is good value, like the value that you're getting with these products. And I think maybe there's a little onus on some of us content creators to always, you know, demonstrate that there are cheaper alternatives and how they compare, and direct comparisons by being able to see or hear or, you know, visualize the difference in some way is just so useful to the consumer. And I can see from the outside perspective, if they've never used an Elgato product, that maybe things might seem overpriced, but trust me, the amount of thought that goes into like the whole ecosystem and even just the convenience for a streamer who is, at the end of the day, if you're a streamer or a content creator, you're doing so many things at the same time. Like, not only managing a stream, trying to be entertaining, you're probably focusing on gameplay, talking with teammates. You want to try and make that whole thing as simple as possible. And I think Elgato has traditionally been amazing in that aspect of working out what they can do to make things easier. Let's move on to talking about the Wave XLR, because I think that one did kind of surprise me, especially seeing how successful Wave 1 and Wave 3, which are both USB microphones, have been. So what was the reason for wanting to enter the XLR or the pro audio space with the interface? Was it many requests from people that wanted to use Wave Link, or was it something that you'd always planned on even prior to designing Wave 1 and Wave 3?
It was mostly in a consequence of people asking to use Wave Link with their existing microphone. And just the, I think, unwavering popularity of mics like the SM7B, right? I mean, you're both using it. The microphone is just kind of a mainstay across Twitch and YouTube and Spotify and whatever. So I think for us, it was, you know, how do we make something that we invested into and that we think actually provides value for creators? How do we make that accessible? And you know, one way which we thought very fitting was an audio interface that's also optimized to work really well with demanding microphones like this one. And in many ways, it's Wave XLR is a Wave 3 in a box, if you think of it. just to made to work with any XLR mic you want to throw at it.
Yeah, and you called out the Shure SM7B specifically, which, I mean, was that a big piece of what you considered when you were developing that? Because, I mean, Pete did the video on it, and it was, how many streamers used this mic?
Almost 50% of the top 250 streamers were using the SM7B. Second place, I think, I can't remember what it was, maybe the Rode Procaster was less than 8%.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And this is a, you know, basically 50-year-old mic that's practically unchanged in its past 50 years of existence. So, you know, this thing is not going away. It's as much culture as technology, or probably more culture than technology. So, you know, we're looking at how people are using these mics, and a lot of people are investing a lot of money into just getting this mic to run. So when people are buying, you know, dedicated preamps for $150 just to provide enough gain to this microphone, that seemed to us like a fairly inefficient thing to do. So we thought, with, you know, a dedicated XLR interface that handles the, you know, a fairly demanding mic like that, but also opens up new features, you know, features in hardware that are unique, like clip guard, like the capacitive mute, and features in software that we have something that, you know, we think is pretty compelling for someone that sets out and decides, okay, I want to use an SM7B, or I want to use an RE20. And either I'm not happy with the interface I have, or I just don't have one yet. And this is my next upgrade.
I think one of the things I was so happy that you guys did when designing Wave 1 and Wave 3 was obviously partnering with Lewitt. And I'm glad to see that you did that again. And in my review, I mentioned that the most important thing with any audio interface is the preamp and the quality of the components actually inside. It doesn't matter how many faders you have on a device. If the preamp sucks, or the analog to digital converter sucks, then it's not going to sound good, and then people aren't going to use it. So I'm amazed at the quality and the amount of power that you can provide with a device at that price point. What was the whole process like of working with Lewitt, both through Wave 1 and Wave 3, as well as now with Wave XLR? Was that the kind of thing where you spoke to various different companies, or did you send out a spec sheet and hope somebody could design things, or was it very, you know, very hands-on throughout that you guys were working hand in hand?
So the story of working together is when we decided, you know, we had sort of defined what a microphone or audio solution would look like for us. That was when we were defining what is today Wave 1 and Wave 3. We wanted to find a partner with whom we could bring this to market, because we wanted to find someone who just had, you know, we've got a lot of video experience and we have audio experience as well, but not to the point where we felt comfortable that we would be able to on our own deliver a mic that's going to be just purely on an audio quality level second to none, or at least holds up with whatever is considered best in class. So we were looking to partner with someone, and we spoke to a lot of different companies, you know, a lot of different big names, small names, and Lewitt was, you know, that dynamic where we just sort of hit it off, and we had a very similar understanding of what we thought made sense. And the guys at Lewitt are an incredibly hands-on R&D driven organization. So when you go to their headquarters in Vienna, you can just completely geek out, right? They custom built the studio at the heart of their office, which is, got a video on their YouTube channel now, you should check it out. It's one of the most impressive studios I've ever seen. And then they just do everything themselves. You know, they will literally 3D print an enclosure, put a capsule in, you know, put it in a studio, measure the hell out of it, and just optimize the thing for a certain use case. So it became pretty clear that they're the perfect partner for us to work with, because we're just combining, you know, really deep insights across the board, which we were confident would help us bring to market a pretty good product. And so we partnered up for Wave 1 and 3. And, you know, Wave XLR was the next project we set out on. And, you know, we're working on more stuff, and we'll continue to work on more stuff. I mean, it's a pretty fun partnership that we have going on. And I expect we're going to see a lot of products come to life as part of this partnership.
That's exciting
to see what, have to see what comes next. Speaking of on top of Wave XLR, I know there's been a lot of discussions around some of the VST pieces of the Wave XLR, and there's been some rumors going around about things like compression, EQ, noise gates, and wavelength. So not to put you on the spot, but is there anything you can share on the show?
No, it's good to talk about it, because we when we launched Wavelength, that was quickly one of the number one requests. And I think even back then we said, yeah, we're looking into this and we're going to work on this. Now it's 1 year later, everyone's asking, rightfully so, well, where the hell is it? So it's definitely taking us a lot longer than we would have liked, and we've sort of had plans that we completely scrapped and now are going in a completely different direction. But it is in active development now, and you know, I don't really share timelines on software stuff because from my experience they never hold up. But it's in the works, and we hope it's going to be pretty cool and pretty universal. And you know, I think we fully understand, especially for a product like Wave XLR, this is really, really important, because whatever mic you throw at it, you're probably going to want to fine tune a little bit and not just use it out of the box.
That's really exciting to hear. I know that there's been some shared rumors and things like that, so it's really great to hear directly from you that it's something that Elgato are actively working on. We can all cross our fingers and hope that that comes sooner rather than later. And obviously, as soon as it does get released, Gaming Careers will do a video there and look into all the settings that you can customize for your microphone. That's exciting times. So you're going to
see
able to
it first on Gaming Careers.
Oh, there you go, the exclusive.
There you go.
Let's move on to mic arms. We're not going to go through every single product, but I do think that mic arms deserve to be talked about, purely just because of how much feedback I've had about the low profile version. Mic arms is one that I don't think there's been much innovation in the past 5 years, really. I think you even said in your live stream that there's kind of two mainstays, the Rode PSA-1 and the Blue Compass, and obviously there's some much more expensive solutions that radio shows use that are low profile. But we haven't really seen anyone enter that space or anyone even try and compete with these two giants of mic arms. So what was the decision to come in and build two separate different mic arms, and why did you end up going with two different designs? Did you see that there was a real use case for people wanting that low profile design, and yeah, which one do you prefer?
So why we got into it was sort of the same reason why we made a green screen, and we never really intended to make a green screen. We just kind of, from using the existing versions, kind of grew tired of them and started asking ourselves, is this really the best thing there is on the market? I think the real kicker back then was when we were at an event and we had these fold-up green screens, which, you know, I'm sure you've seen, and the thing literally exploded in my face, at which point I just got so upset. I said, this can't be what everyone's buying and working with. Like, there's got to be a better way. So we ended up making a green screen. And this was much the same way. You know, I think the mic arms that are on the market are great, and for a lot of people they do their job and most people are perfectly happy with them. But when you're using them every day, you start finding little things that bother you and you start asking yourself, why has no one fixed this? So with some it might be, you know, their weight handling. They work great with one mic, they don't really with another mic. The thing starts moving or sagging or whatever. Then it's cable management, or it's, you know, some are great with freedom of movement, others are less so, and you've got to keep manually adjusting them. There are all these things that came together where we just sort of said, well, we feel pretty confidently we can make something that's better here. And that was the traditional Wave mic arm, which is the form factor that sort of everyone knows and is used to. And then the low profile one was, you know, as you said, it's used in kind of radio stations, and that's where we took the inspiration from. That's where we saw it for the first time. We saw, wow, this is a form factor we're not really seeing anybody using on YouTube or Twitch. How come? Because it actually makes a lot of sense to have this thing that's just, you know, very minimalistic in a way that you can just tuck away under your monitor. That also really isn't in frame if you don't want it to be. So I'm using the low profile arm right now, and all you see is my mic here. And we started exploring that space and seeing that all the options that are available, while, you know, they're really well built, they're prohibitively expensive. And that's when we started looking into, well, can we make something that's similar profile but just more affordable? And that's how we ended up at the low profile mic arm, which I personally love. I'm a big fan of it. The thing is built like a tank, you know, all metal. I think the magnetic cable channels are great, and just how sort of minimalistic it is something that really appeals to me.
It's made me completely reconsider. I'm like trying to work out how I should actually design my setup when I don't have to think about a mic arm, like where I could put the low profile one under which monitor and things like that. And like I said in my review, exactly like you said in your answer there, I feel like you have to kind of spend 2 or 3 weeks with a mic arm to really understand what you like and don't like about it, because
yeah,
you've also got to put in those repetitions of adjusting it, moving it out of the way, making sure it holds up. So I'm going to basically be spending a couple of weeks with each of the mic arms that I've got and just noting down any thoughts and then putting that into a video altogether. But I personally, just based on the feedback that I've seen from the gaming careers community, I think that is going to be a massive hit, the low profile version, especially when people actually realize that $100 is what you pay for a good mic arm. So these are very reasonably priced and have some of the features that others don't have. So yeah, that would be my guess for this sleeper product for Elgato from their release.
Yeah, I think it'll actually start being used with non-microphone products as well. I think it's going to work great for just positioning a camera somewhere. Probably even positioning a light if you need it in a certain location for, you know, if you're doing drawing, painting stuff, could be pretty nice for that. So yeah, it's a really nice product. It's also the feedback we're getting. You know, the thing is sold out on our web store already, unfortunately.
Wow.
But sure, there's a lot of that going on.
I'm just looking, staring at it. It's a nice product. I'm quite fond of it.
That's awesome. Hopefully I'll get to try those as well, because the low profile, like you said, does make a lot of sense for streaming. And also things like the riser, having that too, and just give you more flexibility. I think also just having more options as a streamer is great, whether it's a mic or light or anything else.
Yeah. And that comes back to, you know, attention to detail on the Wave mic arm. You've got that optional riser, which is a nice touch if you need it. You've got the counterweight, which is kind of custom fitted to the arm. So if your mic is too light, you just add the counterweight, you're good to go. So it should really work for everybody in basically all scenarios.
That's awesome. I think let's get off the Elgato products for a second and get your thoughts on the streaming industry as a whole, because someone like you, you've been involved basically from the start, and you've seen how much this industry has changed. And obviously Elgato has done fantastically well and has definitely helped grow this space and benefited from how big live streaming and content creation has become. What are your thoughts of the live streaming space right now, the platforms of Twitch, YouTube and Facebook? Do you get to watch any of these? Do you have a favorite, or any thoughts on the platform wars going on right now?
I mean, I'm a YouTube fanboy. I think I can say it flat out. It's just, that's where I've over the past years just spent the most time. I love, well-edited videos that people have put a lot of thought into. You know, that's why I enjoy watching your reviews. They're carefully crafted. It's just a great source of information and entertainment. That having been said, you know, I definitely spend time on Twitch every now and then. It's just a lot more time consuming. You know, I think on Twitch, the notion that you're going to jump into a stream for 15 minutes and get a lot of value out of it, it's not really there. You'll get that value on YouTube. So for me personally, that's why YouTube is probably the preferred platform. And yeah, I mean, the evolution of all these platforms has been fascinating. We launched our first product in 2012, which is, I believe, the year Justin TV rebranded to Twitch. So we've been participating in the space for a long time. Seeing the growth of YouTube, the growth of Twitch has been phenomenal. Facebook, you know, coming in and it seems like now seriously trying to build a sustainable creator ecosystem is very promising. And I think one of the biggest trends we're seeing right now is that sort of with whenever we think we're reaching a peak, there's a new platform that comes out of nowhere and sort of changes the entire paradigm. And that platform right now is TikTok. Just in terms of how many people it's turning from viewers into creators, it's absolutely amazing. I think the kind of standard rule of thumb that we've worked with is on any given platform, you have 90% who are pure viewers. They don't upload any content. 9% are sort of in between. They'll sometimes upload stuff, but not consistently. And really 1% of creators are the ones that are going all in and really regularly creating content for years on end. And that's held up for many years. With TikTok, you're looking at stats that are saying, you know, half of all people on TikTok create content on TikTok, which is insane. And what you're seeing is that just that the barrier to entry keeps coming down, it keeps getting easier. And who knows where this is going to go, right? Also, audio only stuff like Clubhouse or now everybody's copy of Clubhouse just makes it incredibly easy to put out content. You don't really need anything. You have your phone and a pair of AirPods, and you can open up a room and see what happens. So we're now at a phase again where it feels like, you know, it could explode in all kinds of directions. And in parallel to that, you have the whole all these sort of creator monetization tools that are exploding left and right. That's just making it more and more feasible to turn a hobby into a side hustle and to turn a side hustle into a full-time job if you want. So it's all pretty exciting. And to me, even having been in the space for 10 years now, it still feels like it's very much the early days. Yeah. There's so much that's still going to happen.
Well, that's cool. I think we were going to ask about your thoughts on TikTok and Clubhouse. So you already covered that pretty well. But you mentioned you've been on the platform for about 10 years now. Can you kind of cover how you kind of got involved with Elgato and the backstory? Like, has your position changed over the years? Has the company brand changed over the years? I think people would love to hear kind of your own perspective there.
Yeah, the backstory is a very personal one. Elgato was founded in 1999 by my parents, actually. So, and they founded it in Los Gatos, California. That's where the name came from. So my dad was a software engineer. He, back then, we were living in Germany. He sold his software startup to a company in Silicon Valley. So we moved there. After he worked there for a while, him and my mom started Elgato, which originally, or for many years actually, was in the TV business. So, you know, they basically did TV for Mac. That's how it started. It was like a little stick that you would put in and you would receive, you know, terrestrial television over an antenna or over a cable. And then it had software that let you record it and time shift it and DVR it and a program guide and all that stuff. So that's where the video heritage of the business comes from. I joined in 2011 when there were sort of these thoughts of making a product for recording gameplay. And then what had happened is the YouTube community had sort of picked up on the software that Elgato was developing called ITV, which was the software for watching and recording TV. And they loved it because it had this function of time shifting, which on a Skybox or something or a TiVo is standard, right? In the TV space, it's standard. For gameplay recording, it wasn't. And what people loved about it is they could just let this thing run for hours on end. If their gameplay sucked, they just quit the software. You don't have to mess with gigabytes of files. If they liked it, they could just rewind back in time, hit record, that was it. And so at that point in time, in 2010, 2011, it was a question of, okay, what do? Do you combat the piracy of the software, which always seems like a losing game, or do you try to figure out what's going on and double down on that? And so we went with the latter, and that's when I joined the company to basically spearhead that project. And that ended up being our first product, the Elgato Game Capture HD, which is sort of a very simplified recording solution for back then PS3 and Xbox 360 to let you upload to YouTube. And that became quite popular, and then we sort of built on from there. At that point, you know, it was a product within a company that was doing completely different things. I think it was like 2015 then that we decided, okay, well, we should probably treat this like a business and separate it out a little bit. And then in 2018, we ultimately made the decision to sell that business to Corsair. And as part of that, myself and a lot of colleagues joined Corsair. And the other half of what used to be Elgato is now a separate business called Eve, which makes smart home products specifically for Apple HomeKit.
And do your parents still work on that side of things?
Yeah, they do.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I bet that's a family that has done very, very, very well for themselves with branching out into two different product lines and still doing doing very well. So I remember the Elgato HD60, and it's funny that so many people still use the word Elgato as just like how to capture gameplay. Like, have you got an Elgato? And I'm like, yeah, but which one have you got? And they're like, no, I've got an Elgato. And I'm like, yes, but there's a whole line of products now. It's not just one.
The ultimate sign that you've done well in a specific product category is when you start having your brand name associated with a certain act of doing something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's sort of the quick history of Elgato. So the company has existed for a long time. It used to do very different stuff. And then sort of in the kind of 2010 era had a little bit of an identity crisis, as you know, the TV space was seeding to streaming, and it became clear, okay, well, we got to do something else. So we tried all kinds of stuff. We had, God, back then we launched a thing called Smart Key, which was a little Bluetooth thing that you attach to your keychain so you wouldn't lose it. So now Apple launched AirTags a few months ago. So we were trying that stuff so long ago that the tech wasn't really there and the experience really sucked. So none of that survived to these days. One of the few things that stuck was back then the game capture line, and you know, everything that we sort of built after that.
It's such an inspiring story, I think, for many creators, and it's Elgato sort of become the mainstay brand that people think of when they're talking about creating. Do you have to ever consider live streamers versus content creators when you're designing a product, or do they both kind of fit into the same niche?
Certainly for Stream Deck, we had live streamers in mind at its core, just because you're juggling so many things that we felt it was important to have a tool to streamline that entire process a little bit. I mean, we did think that it could be used for other applications as well, but at least in the initial stages of designing that product, it was very, very clearly tailored to a live streaming workflow. In general, though, I don't really like the differentiation. To me, it's, you know, content creator is sort of the overarching term, and you know, I don't really care if that's live or on demand or pure audio or whatever it is. You know, if you're creating some sort of original content that's entertaining or educating or whatever it is, then to me you're a content creator, and your product needs are certainly going to be different in some aspects. You know, a podcaster's audio needs are going to be different than maybe a YouTuber's audio needs. But in most ways, or in many ways, they overlap. So
I think
you can build overarching solutions.
I think the way that this whole industry is going anyway is that live streaming is just going to become a part of the content that you produce as a content creator. We've already seen that it's difficult for new streamers to grow solely if they're just concentrating on live streaming the whole time. So I'm often encouraging people to start YouTube channels or TikTok channels and creating content there because they're more discoverable, and then moving them across. And I think that's for me why YouTube is quite an appealing platform, is because they're building a way for creators to create whatever type of content they want. If it's vertical video, if it's live streamed video, or if it's traditional, you know, highly produced long content video form. So I think live streaming is just going to become a part of a content creator's toolkit that they'll have to use if they want to continue to grow.
I think streaming suffered a little bit from being the buzzword of the last few years. And this becomes apparent, you know, when I talk to industry partners or retailers, they really cling on to this term of live streamer. They can't really handle the term content creator. It's too general for them. They don't really know what to make of it. So live streamer is something very specific. And that's why you see, I think, a lot of the conversation so predominantly focused on live streaming. The numbers don't tell that story, and this is, you know, also constantly something I have to preach within our own organization. Is, you know, 80% of watch time is VOD. It's not live. YouTube really is the giant gorilla in the back of the room here, even if everybody else is talking about Twitch and Facebook and whatever else.
Yeah, we've often said, haven't we, on this show, Ben, that as soon as YouTube really wants to push live streams, they just have to make one simple change and start recommending them on the homepage or in the sidebar, and then all of a sudden viewership's going to skyrocket because they've already got so many people on their platform watching podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all over after that. I mean, I was going to ask too, Jillian, do you think platforms like TikTok are here to stay in terms of really cutting into that kind of pie of watch time and what is really considered the main content platforms?
That's an interesting question. I really don't know. I think what we've seen in the past is that these platforms can all live alongside each other and really work to support each other. I mean, I think there's already a lot of creators who have, you know, their singular presence on TikTok, and it'll be interesting to see if some of them will branch out into longer form content on YouTube. You know, if TikTok will open up the platform for longer form content. I do think TikTok is here to stay simply because it's done so much to lower the barrier of content creation itself. That is just, it really is an amazing platform for people to get their first experience of putting stuff together and remixing it. And I don't think any platform has come close to making it that easy. And I do think that the result of that might be that we're going to see this, you know, sort of ambitious TikTok creators distribute amongst all kinds of other platforms. Maybe they'll start a podcast and put it on Spotify. Maybe they'll start creating longer form videos on YouTube. Maybe they'll build, you know, a more tight-knit community on Twitch. So I think all these things start to come together.
Wait, you've taught us that we need to get onto TikTok, Ben. We can't keep being boomers about this. We keep talking about it every week in our podcast, and we're like, yeah, is it going to be around forever, or is it going to be Snapchat and kind of die off? But I think it's a really interesting platform. I'm just surprised at how well vertical video has done. I think if you'd asked me before any of these platforms started doing vertical video, I'd have been like, no, it doesn't work. Like, think about how the human eye sees wider than it does see tall. Like, it's going to be 16:9 or 21:9. For life, but we need to start some kind of clips channel for the podcast maybe and start uploading those to TikTok. And
I think that would do really well.
Well, there you go. I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up. I want to say personally, thank you so much, Julian, for all you've done in the space, all the products that you've worked on over the past 10 years. I think Elgato is one of those brands that's really pushed the live streaming space forward and enabled creators like me to be able to do this as a full-time job. So fingers crossed that continues to happen. You keep making good products and you keep thinking about the streamer and the content creator, because that's always been the ethos that I've seen come through from your products. Like, you're just trying to solve problems in a really efficient and elegant way. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on. And thanks for everybody in chat. I know we got a lot of questions and comments. Hopefully we managed to answer some of those in our questions. But yeah, I think it was a really useful podcast for anybody that wanted to learn a little bit more about Elgato and about these new products. So I think that'll do it for this week, but we are back next week with a normal show, loads of news to cover because we haven't done a normal news show for a few weeks now. So it'll probably be a pretty long one, but as long as Ben, you're around next Monday, then we should have our normal podcast. So yeah, all that's left to do is to thank Julian once again, and we will catch you all next time.
Bye. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thank you so much, Julian. It was awesome to have you on, man.
Yeah. Hey, thank you guys. Really, really pleasure to talk to you, and happy to do it again sometime.